I'm Jason Albert, and you are listening to the Faster Skier Podcast. This is episode one of a two-part interview with Marty Hall. In this episode, Hall discusses the start of his career, suspicions about doping, and the five words he'd use on his epitaph. Before we get to that, here's the short version of Hall's bio. Hall won the Ski Meister Award in prep school and skied at the University of New Hampshire. He had decade-long tenures with both the U.S. national team and the Canadian national team. Hall then spearheaded the planning and construction for the 1995 Thunder Bay World Championships. If that isn't enough, he became Bowden's head cross-country ski coach. He did that for 8 years and formally retired in 2007.
So I'm Marty Hall. I'm 78 years old now. And greatest moments of my life was in 1945. We lived in New York City. And, of course, the war was coming to an end. And we had talked to our parents, my two sisters and I, about moving out of the city. And when I say we're in the city, we lived close enough so that we could see the Empire State Building. And so we were going to be moving to a little town in New Hampshire called Guilford. And it'll make me a little teary-eyed here because, like I say, it was one of the greatest moments of my life because I started skiing that year. We moved in November, and by December, we were skiing. And we were on pine boards and a little toe strap, that's all. Bamboo poles and... every day after school, I was 8 years old at that time when I started skiing in December. And it was ironic that at that time, another 8 or 9 or 10 families moved into Guilford, I think for the same reason maybe. And they all had young children in the same age bracket. And right after school every day, out the door skiing when we had snow.
Fast forward a few years, and Hall eventually came into his own when he started working with the U.S. ski team in 1968.
And also in 1969, we started the women's cross-country program, and I became the coach of that program. Also, one of the other things that happened was that I became the first full-time paid cross-country coach for the U.S. ski team, which is a big step forward. Before that, everybody was only paid for 9 months. But had a tenure of, I started in 68 actually and stayed until 78. And I shifted back and forth. I started the women's program, took that through to 72. Then I became the head coach. Then I became the men's coach in 76. And was that until I left in 78. And then the Canadians came down to recruit me, or didn't come down that first year. They just sent me the information, and they made it so that I couldn't get my forms back into them in time so that I didn't get the job. But the next year, they came. The cross-country committee chairman, Dave Reese, drove down to my house, gave me the forms, had me fill them out, took them back, and so then I ended up in Canada for the next 10 years. And that pretty much ended my international coaching involvement in a way. I left their program in 92.
When did you first perceive that perhaps doping was taking place in international skiing?
1974. World Ski Championships following Sweden, ladies 10K race, Martha Rockwell. Martha Rockwell and two other European skiers were in the top 12. The other nine people were all Iron Curtain people. They were East Germans. They were Czechs. And of course, Russians made up that top group. Martha was sixth with a K to go. She started last in the race, and the course guard at a certain location thought all the races had gone by and was standing beside the track. You won't believe this. With his poles under his arms, with his back to the track because he thought all the races had gone by. And here came Martha in a crouch, a tuck, and her skis stuck out, a pole stuck out behind her, normally under her armpits. His pole went in her pole, okay, and knocked her down. And she had 1K to go, so she lost four places with that mix-up. Got knocked down, did a windmill fall because she didn't realize it was going to happen. It happened so quick. Got up and charged to the finish. Very embarrassing situation. But when I started to, because of Martha's placings, I really, you know, was going over the results. And I said, I said it to myself and kept it to myself, essentially. This is not, you know, the Iron Curtain World Championships. This is the World Championships. Where are the Norwegians? Where are the Swedes? Where are the Finns? I mean, just for starters, there were, I'm not sure who the other two girls were, but most likely a Finn and a Norwegian would be my, you know, if I thought of who would be in that group. But I said, this is ridiculous. Another thing that comes to mind is we had a relay race, you know, World Cup relay race. And the West German girls beat the East German girls in this race. And it was near the end of the season. The next year, all four of those East German girls were not around at all. I mean, they just disappeared. Four new girls. How many programs can take shift their four best girls, who they think their four best girls are, shake them out, and, you know, they never are seen again, and four new girls come in.
What Hall may be most infamous for is accusing the Russians of doping at the 88 Calgary Winter Games. It became a seismic event that ruffled feathers in and out of the cross-country scene.
So, over the years, I just get the feeling, and I finally just, in Calgary, I just, you know, we had the first two races, the men's 30 and the ladies 15, I think it was. And the girls, I think, you get four in each event by Olympic rules, regulations, but they also have an extra place if you have the winner of the event from the last Olympics. She gets a bonus place. So either the Russians had, I think, five girls, and all five of their girls were in the top six. The boys raced, all four of their boys were in the top five, four, something like that. And I never really accused them. I just said at the press conference afterwards, I said, this ain't the Russian championships, you know. And so somebody said to me, what's that mean? I said, you figure it out. And so then I went over to the suppliers' camp. They had an area that set off for them near the race courses, and was at the Adidas cabin having some schnapps and a drink. But I had my radio turned on, and I got this little message from my girl, Sheila, who was my PR lady. She says, Marty, you better get your ass over here. All hell is breaking loose. And so they had figured it out that I had accused the Russians of doping. And you know, that when it came out in the paper the next day, what's kind of interesting is on my article was on the left-hand side on the front page about me and all that stuff I did. And everybody who wanted to run me over was making their quotes. Over on the right side, in the thin column, but still on the front page, was an article about erythropoietin and how it was being used to boost blood building in people with kidney failures. And so I'm saying, you can't be too far off, Marty. If they're talking about it in this newspaper on that side, and really that's what we're talking about on this side, although they may have been blood doping the old way where they centrifuged the person's blood and gave it back to him, blah, blah, blah. And the other thing that happened was when I went back over, the chef de mission for the Canadian team had relayed a message to me through the radios or telephone or whatever that I had to write an apology to the Russians. And I said, and look, I after all of that, there was one other situation. After all that my athletes had gone through and everybody else, and nobody else would talk about it. Jesus, I couldn't believe the other coaches, but who knows what the hell they were all doing. And some of them came out to be dopers after I left the sport, especially the Finns and the Italians.
Just to take a step back a little bit. So when you kind of made, you know, whether or not they were formal or informal comments alluding to the fact that, you know, you thought the Russians were doping. So and then the next day that article came out, and this is just your words. I guess the article about you was about folks who wanted to run you over. So it sounded like the chief of the Canadian mission wasn't too pleased. Who else?
Oh, Jesus. Hey, the chef de mission, he's the guy who leads the Olympic team. How about the sport minister? He told me to shut up. He wrote me a letter and said, oh, your venue up there is beautiful. I had a great day watching the race, but blah, 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 blah. Marty, shut up. You're in hot water. I'll tell you what. When I went back to my room that night, we were in a trailer park for our Olympic Village. I'll bet you there were 10 or 15 notes on my door, little notes saying, call today, USA Today. I mean, call, I don't know. I call every morning show. Every morning show in the United States on TV wanted to talk to me. And I didn't look at, I said, this is the gist of all these notes. Took them off the door. Gave him to my lady. The one thing I had to think about is I wanted to keep my job. Gave them to this lady, Sheila, my PR lady, and I said, you get a hold of all these guys and tell them I won't be there. I'm not available. And I had been told not to be available. And if I had it to do over again, that's the part I would do differently. I would have gone forward. And the thing that ended up really still bothers me to this day, my top athlete, Pierre Harvey, who was ranked fifth in the country, in the world, on the World Cup circuit the year before, couldn't get in the, could barely break the top 15. Okay? And came to me at the end of the games because we were going to be going back to Scandinavia for some races in home called Oslo and in Sweden. And he came to me and said, I won't be going back to Europe. And when his wife heard that, his wife is a doctor and very involved in sport. And we used her a lot of times on trips with us to have medical protection so we didn't have to rely. And she took him aside and said, you're going to Europe. You're going back over there. I'll tell you, you're going back over there. There's no question about it. You're going to go over there and race. He won both races. A 50K and a 30K and following, he won. This is a World Cup circuit. And the 50K in Holmenkollen, he won. And 50K in Holmenkollen, to race the 30K, had to get out of bed. He was... had been sick, and just barely won that race. But by the next weekend, he was back in form, and he was killing everybody in there. He went by Ulvang, he went by Svahn, one right after the other. They're all seated close together, and he looked back to see where they were at one point in the race. He dropped them. He was so far ahead, it was ridiculous. At the end of the race, because I think he started to slough off a little bit, some Italians were starting to close in on him, and I had to get some guys to go back out on the course and tell him to get his ass back in gear. But he told me, I won't be trying out for the team anymore. He says, look, I'm in the top five in the world. I'm beating all these guys all the time in both techniques. He said, I'm not doing this anymore.
So behind closed doors, you know, with your coaching staff, say at Calgary, you know, what was the headspace like with, you know, that frustration, or I suppose there's frustration with, you know, the effort being put forth and how that may manifest on a result sheet.
Boy, I can't say. So there is a story I can tell you that confirmed more than anything else what I had done. So we're up at the venue for a workout, and we were going back down to the village in a van, 8 or 9 of us, whatever. And there was a Norwegian girl. Her name was Anetta Bo, and she should be an American. She loved to swear and just carries on. And I wasn't driving. I was sitting in the next seat back from the drivers. And she gets in the van and looks around to see who's in there, because they all know each other. She sees me, and she jumps over the seat and gives me a hug. "You son of a bitch, Marty. You did it. You're so humble. I love you, blah, blah, blah."
She was excited that you had...
I'd ratted him out, yeah.
In Calgary, were there any formal doping controls at that time?
Oh, yes, the procedure was there, yeah.
And what would that entail, a urine test?
Yeah, exactly. But back then, they didn't have an individual go with them. You go in the bathroom by yourself, and there were a lot of urine samples that came out of bike tubes or a little belt that they would put around their waist that would have their urine in it when it was pure. I mean, all you have to do is look at this report, Jason, and my God, I mean, it's so complete, so thorough, and so many people involved, and so many medical people. I mean, it just, so.
Let's, before we jump to, because I'm about to, yeah, we'll introduce sort of this new.
But I'm just using it as a sighting of how this is a profession, and it was back then for them. I mean,
do you think, you know, I don't know, and maybe you can describe how you ended up leaving Canada, or at least that job, but do you think that was the beginning of the end for you?
No, what happened was, is I think I could have gone for another 8 years easily, but we got to 92 and we had a prime minister change, and he was really funny. He used this ploy to make people think he was putting money back, more money into the budget, when he was really stripping everybody. It was called the Red Book. And everybody was in the Red Book as to what their numbers were going to be increased to. But he just defunded the hell out of sport. Just totally defunded. I had to fire 3 coaches. You know, you say, I had to let them go. I didn't fire them. I just went to them and said, "Hey, our budget is going down the, it's going down the drain so bad. We went from having coaching for something like 40 athletes. I mean, we had a really great situation going. We had a development coach. We had a junior coach. We had a senior coach. And then there was myself. And so we had a huge number of athletes in the pipeline, and that were being coached at all levels, had formal programs, training camps, use of the supplier pool, all kinds of free equipment. We had a hell of a supplier pool at that time in Canada. I built a pool where, back in those days, I generated enough business so that we had over $100,000 in cash out of the pool, plus all, I mean, from the underwear out, we had everything. And all free. I mean, and we took care of 30, 40 athletes like that. So when that happened, I said, you know, I could have gone on maybe, but that was like, you know, eating cake with no icing. you were just going to be struggling again to do anything or everything. And, you know, it meant that we didn't have a program anymore. I left Canada nobody ever got in my face that was involved in cross-country skiing. Nobody. Other than who I am, because I'm when I'm in that business, I'm straight ahead.
What do you mean by that? Who are you?
I'm a tough guy. I run the show. That's why I left the U.S. Left the U.S. program. The athletes wanted more control, and that's not the way. The athletes come and go, coaches come and go. The program's always there. The program runs the show. So I happen to be the leader down in the States. There were a couple of times when I took some athletes and did things to them that they didn't like, but were for their own good. They were sick. And so anyway, like I said, hey, I'll give you one, Jason. Okay? You've got 20 seconds to write your epitaph in 5 words. My wife came home one night with that. And before she was almost done, in other words, you got 5 words, Marty, and you got 20 seconds. I said, I did it my way. Like that, just about that fast. So sometime, spring that on your wife and see what she can do.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a couple of years.
You know, it's really, and the thing is you know, I've done it so many times. It's interesting when you say you've got 20 seconds and 5 words. You can't believe how people tighten up. You can't think.
Yeah, I was at a blank right there. I was like, I don't know if I'm there yet. So let's a couple of things. You know, set
so I'm a tough guy. You will hear it straight from me. There's no politicking. I hate politics. A lot of my writing, stuff that I do is good, complimentary, but when you cross over and do something stupid, you're going to hear about it.